This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, April 2nd, 2012. I'm Kyle Kellums. In a moment, a national effort to reduce deaths and injuries caused by heat stroke. The CEO of the Corey String Institute recently was on the University of Arkansas campus to discuss ways to eliminate heat stroke deaths for athletes. And we'll continue to salute partnerships with Chef David Lewis of BHK Cafe in Fayetteville. He'll create some intriguing and perhaps unconventional food pairings for us. And speaking of partnerships, this week is all about the best partnership in radio, you and KUAF. We provide the programming. You provide the biggest part of the financial resource we use to bring you the programming. 1-800-522-5823 or 575-5823. We'll connect you with a phone volunteer. Spend a couple of minutes of this Monday showing your support for public radio, KUAF, and Ozarks at Large. You determine the amount of your financial contribution. If it is easier for you to get to a keyboard, you can pledge online as well at KUAF.com. I'd like you to think about a contribution to KUAF maybe the same way you think about maintaining your home or your car. Regular maintenance takes a little effort. Not always something we want to do at that very moment. And it does have a cost, but agreed, the oil change, the new gutters, it goes a long way, right? Giving public radio and KUAF just a bit of money every now and then brings you the unrivaled news coverage that you count on every day. Whether it's national programming like Morning Edition or Talk of the Nation, or something that is very specific to your part of the world like Of Note with Katie Hendrickson or Ozarks at Large. We'll send NPR more than $145,000 an hour for every hour of Morning Edition and All Things Considered that you listen to this year. That's just those programs. Giving your support during this fundraising week, giving your support right now, helps us to keep paying so you can keep listening to the quality that you only hear on KUAF. Think of making your financial contribution to KUAF as that bit of maintenance, doing a little bit now to ensure that you can still get the best radio in the area all year long. You can make your maintenance contribution at 575-5823, or you can call 800-522-5823. You can also pledge online at KUAF.com. And of course, thank you for your continued support of Public Radio KUAF and local news on Ozarks at Large. Exertional heat stroke is one of the leading causes of sudden death in sports. Last week, Douglas Casa, the chief operating officer of the Corey Stringer Institute, visited the University of Arkansas to present a lecture titled Top 10 Ways to Prevent Sudden Death in Sport. During his visit, he came to KUAF and he talked with Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda about how an experience nearly three decades ago influenced his life's work today.
In 1985, I was a high school track runner, and I was competing in an event in New York State in Buffalo called the Empire State Games. It's kind of like a summer Olympic Games for high school athletes that we have in New York State. And it was something I had aspired to try to make for many years. I tried after my freshman year, I tried after my sophomore year, and I didn't make the team either time. And then after my junior year, I made it from the Long Island region. So it meant a lot to me. Well, they had it was in August during a heat wave, and they decided to run the 10K race, which is 25 laps on the track. They decided to run that race in the middle of the day. And they were, for instance, running the sprints in the evening under the lights where, you know, not as much risk of heat stroke with sprinting. So, but they had the distance race in the worst time of the day. So there was 25-lap race. On the very last lap, me and two other people were fighting for medals to, you know, either be first, second, or third. And with about 200 meters to go, which is a half a lap, I collapsed, but I immediately got back up. Then about 50 meters to go in the race, on the final straightaway, I collapsed. And I basically went into a coma for about the next 5 or 6 hours. So I was unconscious, suffering from a very severe exertional heat stroke. Very lucky that an athletic trainer was on site and recognized right away I was having heat stroke and immediately started cooling me, got me into an ambulance within a couple minutes where they aggressively cooled me while I was being transported, and I got to the Millard Fillmore Hospital in Buffalo, and then they continued aggressive cooling while I was there. I actually went into a tub full of ice, and then woke up later that afternoon and that evening when I was brought into a room. Keep in mind, my family wasn't there. This is 10 hours from Long Island. So no one was there yet that I really knew. So I went into a room and I actually watched myself. I watched on the local news a story about me having a heat stroke. So that was like at 11 o'clock. And then a cyclist had a heat stroke the same day, like within a couple hours of me in an event at the Empire State Games. He was in a room a couple rooms down from me. Well, when I was watching this, I was like, wow, that sounds really familiar. And then I realized about 15 minutes later that was talking about me on the TV having the heat stroke. And then in sports, 15 minutes later, they covered it again. So I couldn't really shake after, you know, that kind of became ingrained in who I was. And for the next 26 years, that's become my passion. And ironically, in 2001, when I was giving a presentation in Los Angeles after winning an award, a lady sitting in the audience listened to my story of me having my heat stroke. And when my talk was done, she ran out of the room through the convention center in Los Angeles and went to find a person. And she comes back and she says, you know, Doug, I just listened to your story, and about 15 years ago when I was a person at Ithaca College, I listened to that same story from the clinician perspective. So she realized that she had heard the story from Kent Scriber, who's an athletic trainer at Ithaca. He is the one who actually saved my life that day. And I found out 16 years after I had my heat stroke, the person who saved my life, because Cindy Trowbridge, an athletic trainer at University of Texas, she actually connected the two of us after hearing the story from both sides.
Wow. So did you ever get to see him?
Oh, yeah. Kent and I have become very, very good friends. Ironically, he was using a lot of my research and information and education in his classes before he ever knew it was me saved his life. Because, it wasn't until 2001 and he had been using my information even before that. So it was kind of neat when he found out that the guy's life he saved ended up studying this for a living. And we've become very good friends. And it's been a special part of my life.
And a part of the way that you're continuing to talk about this sort of thing is through being the chief
operating officer
of the Corey Stringer Institute.
Yes.
And it's a fairly new organization. Can you tell me a little bit about what it is and what it does?
Sure. In 2001, Corey Stringer was an NFL player for the Minnesota Vikings. He passed away from exertional heat stroke the day after suffering a heat stroke, like on day two of preseason training. And obviously, there's some litigation occurred after he passed away. And I assisted his widow, Kelsey Stringer, with a lot of that litigation. And Kelsey asked me, because we had developed the rapport after I was helping her during the litigation as an expert witness, if we wanted to establish this institute, there would be some good, positive, lasting legacy of the Corey Stringer name if we wanted to establish it at the University of Connecticut. So she decided to give the settlement that they had to us at the University of Connecticut to establish the Corey Stringer Institute. And we've worked very closely with the University of Connecticut, with the NFL, with Gatorade, and now with Timex as our corporate partners to establish an institute that works really hard to do research in the area of preventing sudden death in sport, education, try to advocate for the media to get good information out to people. But we also work extensively, and probably one of our biggest things is trying to get policy changes, especially at the high school level across the country, to try to make changes related to preventing sudden death in sport and policies related to heat acclimatization and AEDs and emergency action plans and coaching education and a lot of different things that we're trying to up the standards for the people who are involved with supervising youth sports.
What are some of the policy changes that you guys have been able to accomplish?
One of the big things we've been working on is this heat acclimatization standards. And I know that's a big fancy word, but heat acclimatization is the body's response to exercise in the heat. And you get a lot better at dealing with exercise in the heat after the first 7 to 10 days of exercising. Your body makes physiological changes so it can better deal with the stress of the heat. So what we've learned from a lot of research is that most heat illnesses in athletes happen in the first 5 to 7 days of activity when they start practice sessions. The NCAA for college football back in 2003 invoked this heat acclimatization policy for college football practices, and they've had great success with dramatically reducing the exertional heat stroke deaths. But at the high school level, you have to go state by state to change the policies. There's no national governing body that has the authority to actually mandate something. You have to do it at the state level. Our first success for many years of working at this was in July of 2011. New Jersey was the first state to adapt minimum standards for heat acclimatization that met the guidelines that we published in 2009. And one of our really great accomplishments, and it's a credit to the leadership in the state of Texas, Mike Carroll, an athletic trainer in Texas, and the people who headed up the High School Athletic Association were proactive. And in October of 2011, Texas voted to overhaul their heat acclimatization standards, which Texas high school football is obviously
a
very, very, very big state. And it was an important state for us. And I give them a lot of credit for being proactive. And what it really means is, like, in the first 4 or 5 days, there's no two-a-day practices. And then you don't have successive days of two-a-days. You also phase in the length and amount of activity. You phase in the amount of equipment. So you're really protecting your athletes in the first 4 or 5, 6, 7 days. You're really doing a lot to try to minimize risk when the risk is highest. Then in addition to that, in the end of 2011, Connecticut came on board. And then we have Georgia and North Carolina now on board. And Georgia was about 10 days ago. They voted to change their heat acclimatization standards for high school football.
I feel like a lot of times when people hear something about this in the news where an athlete has died from something like this, they seem surprised. And is that – do you feel like maybe there's a negligence of considering the welfare of athletes? Because I think people just assume because they're athletic – they are in good health?
I think there's it's multifaceted, that answer, because a little bit of it is people being a little naive. My wife says that some of the things that happen on high school sports fields across America is legalized child abuse, because we do a lot of things that are not in the best interest of athletes. For instance, like, we make them go for a couple hours with no water breaks, no rest breaks, because we're punishing them for a poor performance they had the day before. And that just wouldn't be acceptable in a lot of other situations. But for some reason, we allow our kids to be treated like this on an athletic field. So there's a lot of things we need to do. We need to make sure, first of all, high schools have athletic trainers. Athletic trainers are the medical professionals who take care of athletic injuries. You know, all professional college teams have them, and about half the high schools in America have athletic trainers. Some states, you know, it's near 100%, and some states struggle, and a lot of the bigger high schools tend to have athletic trainers. But that's the real first step in making change, because they know what the correct policies should be to keep them safe. And also, if there's ever a problem, then they're the person who's properly trained to prevent sudden death in sport and to deal with the emergencies. Because most of the things that cause death in sport, if they're going to live or die, is determined on what happens in the first 10 minutes. So you can't depend on what's going to happen when an ambulance arrives, because it might be too late at that point. And you don't want to depend on a coach. Coaches are great at coaching, and we should let them coach. But the athletic trainer is great at saving people's lives. And it's really, when it comes to cardiac, heat stroke, head injuries, exertional sickling, a lot of other very serious situations, it's what you do in the first 10 minutes will be the factor if they live or die. So to get back to the original question you asked, is what causes a heat stroke in the first place, and why someone dies from heat stroke are very different. What causes someone to have a heat stroke are things like they might not be in as good a shape, there's not good work-to-rest ratios, they're not well hydrated, they're not heat acclimatized, they might have a genetic predisposition. There's a lot of different factors. And some of them are intrinsic to the athlete, some of them are extrinsic to the environment, and a coach can control a lot of those things. But what causes someone to die is they're not treated properly. Because when an exertional heat stroke is treated properly, meaning that aggressive cooling begins within 5 to 10 minutes from when the collapse takes place, preferably being cold water immersion. We have had a 100% survival with over 2,000 heat strokes in many different military and athletic settings. So 100% survival using ice, water, and a kiddie pool and aggressive cooling on site. The concept is cool first, transport second. So even if you have an ambulance there, you don't transport them to the hospital. You cool aggressively, then transport to the hospital. So we have 100% survival when it's done right. So when you hear the stories over the summer, and you'll hear the stories this coming summer again, the thing that should get you mad is why did that person die? Why was that person not treated after they had the heat stroke, if we know we can treat them? Now, that doesn't mean we want people to be negligent and not do the things to prevent the heat stroke in the first place, because we need to do those things. But if a heat stroke ever does take place, and you can never prevent all heat strokes from taking place, if you're going to do intense exercise in the heat, the risk of heat stroke is ever present, and you need to be ready to treat it. And that's why you really need to have an athletic trainer on site to institute that on-site aggressive cooling.
Douglas Casa is the CEO of the Corey Stringer Institute. He was on the University of Arkansas campus last week to present a lecture titled Top 10 Ways to Prevent Sudden Death in Sports. He talked with Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda during his visit inside the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio. This is Ozarks at Large. This is Ozarks at Large. In just a few minutes, an international voice in the opera world will perform at Cilla Boyle Smith Concert Hall on the U of A campus tomorrow night. We'll have a preview. And then later, we continue our salute to partnerships this week on Ozarks at Large. by talking about food partnerships with Chef David Lewis of BHK Cafe. That's ahead. I'm Kyle Kellums, producer of Ozarks at Large, something I've been doing now for more than 22 years. And I'm taking just a couple of minutes before we get to our next stories on the program to remind you that the reason we can bring you a program like Ozarks at Large is because listeners like you have contributed money over the past two decades plus. Money that helps keep programs on, like All Things Considered and Talk of the Nation, but also keeps programs on that are about not just the country and the world, but about your part of the world. And I'm talking about Ozarks at Large. Stories from Fort Smith, from Fayetteville, and from everywhere in between. We do appreciate your support. We've been able to grow to a daily program, unlike any other that's on the radio in this area, and we do thank you very much. Think of your listening to KUAF as a lifetime of education. You'll hear something from the Supreme Court, but you'll also hear something from the City Council. You listen because it engages you and stimulates new ways of thinking. Every day, you receive lessons in civics, in science, and culture with access to the best minds in the country. This is the value of an independent news service like KUAF. A lot of people who listen to KUAF believe that public radio is essential. Please take this opportunity to help keep this news service free and strong. You can call and become a financial supporter right now, 575-5823 or 800-522-5823. You can also pledge online at KUAF.com. And thank you.
I'm Robert Siegel, host of All Things Considered, where I have one invariable standard. If I didn't work here, would I want to listen? If I were just a listener, would I want to hear that question posed to that person, that story, that phrase? If I wouldn't, why would you? We don't think of you as a target demographic. We think of you as curious people like us. And in broadcasting today, this is something special. This is NPR.
And this is Ozarks at Large on KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums. Let me echo what Robert Siegel just said. That is exactly the same process that we go through at Ozarks at Large. We have no shortage of stories that we can bring you. One of the fortunate things about working in this area is that there is never a shortage of great interviews, great events, or great stories that we could spend our time working on to deliver to you. What we want to do is make sure we're presenting as many of the right stories for you in the right way. Is it interesting? Is it of use to you? We spend a lot of time trying to figure out what to cover and how to do it. Then we go out and we do the stories. If you appreciate that sort of dedication, that sort of commitment that we have to radio that's not just about the rest of the world and the rest of the country, but our part of the country, please remember your support has made Ozarks at Large possible. Whether it's a story you heard about an upcoming 5K that would help a nonprofit, or it's something about city or state politics you heard on Ozarks at Large, please remember that your support makes these programs possible, including Ozarks at Large. And you can call in your financial support of public radio and KUAF at 800-522-5823. That's 800-522-KUAF. You can also pledge online at KUAF.com. And thank you very much. This is Ozarks at Large for the first Monday in April 2012. Tomorrow night, a top voice in the world of opera will sing live inside Stella Boyle Smith Concert Hall on the University of Arkansas campus. Katie Hendrickson, the host of KUAF's Of Note program, gives us this preview.
There's a big concert coming up here in Fayetteville. Italian soprano Anna Caterina Antonacci will be performing on April 3rd as a benefit for the John Harrison Opera Foundation. Now, this is one of only four performances she's doing on this stateside tour. Earlier this week, Christopher Lacey, who is the president of the board of directors of the John Harrison Opera Foundation, stopped by the KUAF studios to talk about this recital.
She has had a major career in Europe. She's only sung in this country a couple of times. She has opened the season at La Scala many, many times, and that is an honor reserved for artists of the highest caliber. She's rather known as the Callas of our time, the Maria Callas of our time, because she is a very private person, and she is a very, I don't want to use the word temperamental because that implies someone who throws fits. She's not a fit-throwing woman, but she has stage temperament, which means that when she walks on stage, you can't do anything but look at her. She sort of steals the scene without she just standing there. You can't do anything but look at her. So she's got a lot of personal magnetism. She sings Carmen, which is a very fiery role, and that she's coming to Stella Boyle Smith Concert Hall, then to Montreal, then to Ellis Tully Hall, then to Lincoln Center, and we're one of three places in the United States that she's singing is really kind of surreal and wonderful. So the foundation is ecstatic, and no one is more ecstatic than I am because I'm a huge, huge admirer of both Donald Sulzen, her pianist, and Anna Katerina herself. Amazing artists.
I was also able to talk to Antonacci's accompanist, Donald Sulzen, via phone about how he met Anna Katerina Antonacci and how they work so well together.
The story of how I met Antonacci is very, very interesting. I was accompanying a singing competition in Barcelona in 1988, and she was one of the competitors. And I thought that she would surely take first prize, and she didn't even reach the finals. And I spoke to her then, and I said, you know, I'm really sorry. And I said, please don't let this dampen your spirits, because you have a fabulous voice and you're a wonderful singer and you will certainly have a career. And she smiled, and she had just received a certificate that she had reached the semifinals. And she said, thank you. And she turned, tore this little document in half and threw it over her shoulders as she walked away. And 10 years later, she was in Munich performing Popea, and I saw that she was performing, and I left her a note backstage, and I said, you probably forgotten me, but I accompanied you at the Maria Canals competition 10 years ago, and at that time, I said you would have a fabulous career, and it's come true. I said, but if you do by chance remember me, please give me a call. I would love to have a coffee. And she called, and we met for coffee, and I said, you know, it's a pity that we've never performed together. And she said, I can change that. And the next day she called me back, and we had three concerts for the following year. Apparently she had never really found a soulmate at the piano, so it was the best professional coffee date of my career.
Yeah, so tell me, I guess, about that, like how, as far as, like you said, the a soulmate for a pianist who can accompany her. Tell me about how you guys worked together and how that did happen.
When I accompanied her at the competition, I noticed that we basically had the same musical intuition. We didn't have to discuss, well, shall we make a, should we get a little bit slower here? Shall we make a ritardando? Should we move on here? It just fell into place. It's, I guess the best comparison would be if you dance with someone and there are those that you immediately have the feeling, oh, you know, I'm a fantastic dancer. This is wonderful. And then you have those where you feel like you're stepping on someone's toes the entire time. And with her, there was no stress involved. I didn't have to contemplate what she would do. I could always sense what she was going to do. And that's the magic of being a true team on stage. That's the wonderful aspect of music making is when it is not complicated, when it just all falls into place. And that's the relationship that we have.
Solzhen's concert with Antonacci is at the Stella Boyle Smith Concert Hall in the Fine Arts Building on the University of Arkansas campus in Fayetteville on April 3rd at 8 p.m. And tickets are available by calling the Walton Arts Center box office at 443-5600. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Katie Henriksen.
It's Monday, the second day of April, 2012. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me is Becca Bacon-Martin. She is the features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Does it ever worry you that we'll run out of things to write about?
No.
Or talk about?
Not at all.
Weeks like this, I'm not worried either.
April is one of, I think, the two busiest months of the year.
Well, today is the last day for Wonder World.
At Crystal Bridges.
The contemporary exhibition, 11 to 6 today. Crystal Bridges, obviously, in Bentonville. Also on the art scene.
When some of Wonder World will remain up at other places, correct?
Yes.
Not all of it comes down permanently, but some of them come down and have to come down because of exposure to light and will not be back for years.
Right.
Okay, you've been warned.
They will mosey away and hide out. Other things will mosey in. Some things will mosey around.
And we have the Hudson River Valley School coming in.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Also on the art scene, Mare de Seine, an exhibit by John Orr, who's a grad student at the UA, is opening on April 5th, which is Thursday, at Sugar, the UA Student Gallery in Bentonville. There's an artist reception from 6 to 8 on Friday. And there's an exhibit called I Thought I Would Find You Here, paintings by Megan Chapman and Stuart Bremner through the month of April in the Peterson Auditorium in the Shoemaker Global Business Development Center at Northwest Arkansas Community College in Bentonville. Women of a New Tribe, a photography exhibit by Jerry Tolliver in the lobby area at Mullins Library at the UA, and two great museum exhibits, Roadside Attractions, an exhibit of historic Arkansas images that you might have seen along the old highways at the Shiloh Museum of Ozark History in Springdale, and Benton County Crime Stories, an exhibition on the history of law and order in Benton County starting in the 1830s at the Rogers Historical Museum.
Very good. Thank you, Becca. Becca Bacon-Martin is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers. And in just a few minutes, we'll continue our salute to partnerships on Ozarks at Large with food pairings discussed by Chef David Lewis of BH Cafe on Dixon Street in Fayetteville. He'll sit down with Ozarks at Large's Christina Thomas, who will give him some random food items, and he'll come up with, on the spot, some intriguing food partnerships. That's in just a few minutes on Ozarks at Large. We're talking about partnerships on our shows this week because we think the best partnership in public radio, you and us, you the listener and the supporter of public radio and KUAF and Ozarks at Large, and us, the staff at KUAF, bringing you the programming that you hear throughout the year. You can continue your financial support or perhaps become a first-time supporter. Maybe you've been a long-time listener, but you've never contributed financially. You can solve that right now by calling 800-522-5823. 800-522-5823. You can also pledge online at KUAF.com. Our annual operating budget at KUAF is a little over $1.1 million, and those of us on staff here are responsible for raising 90% of that budget. We do it in a number of ways. We do it through some major gifts, grants, local and regional business underwriters, and gifts from our listeners. Listener support makes up the largest and the most reliable portion of our annual revenue at KUAF. That means you play an incredibly important role in this enterprise that we call public radio. Simply put, without your support, without support from you and listeners like you, public radio would not be here, wouldn't exist. NPR would not exist. Ozarks at Large and the stories that you hear would not be here. The importance of your financial support of public radio can't be overstated. So I'm going to ask you, if you haven't yet, to do your part right now and support your public radio station with a contribution. You determine the amount, 575-5823 or 800-522-5823. You can also pledge online at KUAF.com. Consider the importance public radio plays in your life. Perhaps you wake up with Morning Edition, you pick up the kids at school while listening to All Things Considered, you ease into the evening with Terry Gross and Fresh Air, and you hear about what's happening throughout the KUAF listening area with stories and interviews that affect you here on Ozarks at Large. Please consider your financial support as the pillar that keeps Public Radio, Ozarks at Large, and KUAF coming to you 365, or this year, 366 days a year. Again, the numbers, 800-522-5823 or 575-5823. You can also pledge online at KUAF.com, and thank you. And this week, during our fundraising efforts, we're taking a few minutes on Ozarks at Large to examine partnerships. Last Friday, we heard from a father and son juggling and comedy duo. Tomorrow, we'll invite the comedy singing duo of Black and Tan back to the Furman Garner Performance Studio. But for this edition of Ozarks, we're thinking about food partnerships. Ozarks at Large's Christina Thomas asked Chef David Lewis of BHK Cafe in Fayetteville to play a game. She had the names of several foods on slips of paper and put those pieces into our beloved ceramic cow. She then asked David to pick a few out at random and, on the spot, come up with a partner for each ingredient that he would choose.
You know, I've been hearing about this ceramic cow for ages, but this is my first visit with a ceramic cow. This is very exciting. Arugula.
Okay.
Oh, and what happens if I get really excited and 89 pears come into my head? Lemon. Lemon and arugula is amazing, that beautiful, the sort of peppery spiciness of arugula. And you need both parts of the lemon juice and the lemon peel.
Okay. So you're zesting the lemon.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Or actually probably what I would do, especially if we're doing something raw with arugula, is to strip the zest instead of grate it with a microplane. So you've actually got a big piece of lemon that's got sort of that bitterness also, as well as the flavor of the lemon, which sort of ties into that spicy bitterness of the arugula. So those two, that pair of bitterness sort of sits next to each other on your palate, but they don't try to be on the same place on your palate. They make this beautiful sort of companion set. And then you throw the acid from the lemon juice on top of that with a little bit of olive oil to sort of carry that acid around.
Okay.
And that's, you know, sort of really simple and a basis then for sort of throwing other things, you know, into the bowl. You know, some sun-dried tomatoes would be wonderful. Some Parmigiano Reggiano would be wonderful. Some freshly cracked black pepper. You know, if you eat animal protein, some really crispy pancetta or some crispy local bacon would be really great as well.
So, but arugula is something, I feel like I've had it recently as a, like, served wilted underneath a steak.
Absolutely, yeah. So it's sort of and it has that double life, you know, of being able to be a really interesting salad green cold dish ingredient, but then when you add heat to it and either wilt it or saute it or roast it in a really hot oven really quickly, then you get either sort of a condiment potential or a side dish potential. It's great. They're sort of simply wilted, you know, and either folded into really softly scrambled eggs, you know, in the French style, or stuffed into an omelet or used inside of a quiche. Served, as you were suggesting, sort of sauteed under a steak, as we have seen spinach, you know, done a lot. The interesting thing that happens when you heat the arugula is the complexity of the bitterness and the heat softens and diminishes, actually. So it becomes a less complex flavor on your palate, which perhaps moves it sort of from center stage, as we were talking about having it in a simple salad, you know, to moving it towards being a companion.
I like it. Okay. Let's go for second ingredient from the ceramic cow. What do we have?
Beets. I think that maybe you read my mind before you started putting things okay. in the cow, because beets are also one of my favorite things in the whole world.
Stain your hands, though.
They do. So I actually often will wear plastic gloves when I'm working with beets, because if I don't want to be pink, you know, later mm-hmm. in the day. And there are three things that I always think of when thinking about beets. And the first pair is beets in a really slow oven.
So we're roasting them.
We're roasting them in a covered dish somehow, whether it's in a foil pack or in a Dutch oven, because I like beets best when they are really long cooked, so that all of the sugars, all the carbohydrates in there, you know, turn to sugar, and they develop this unbelievably complex set of sweet flavors. Then it's time to make a choice, and the choice is either cardamom or tarragon.
Okay.
And a little bit of cardamom when you put them in the Dutch oven or in the foil pack, so that the flavor and the aroma, you know, is all in there, so it saturates. The beautiful thing about cardamom, I think, is that it is a flavor that's amazing and complex. It is an aroma that is amazing and complex, and the two are different. And so it is one of the best examples of sort of being able to eat with your nose and your mouth, you know, at the same time, and combining those two senses. Its aroma is so strong and maintains itself through the cooking process that you get to enjoy both of those layers of experience.
Okay. So we've had arugula and lemon, beets and cardamom.
Yes.
Let's see what our third...
Let's mix it around in here. Let's see if there's some sugar or something in here.
What is it?
I got more than
what
one.
What is it?
Oh, kale.
We've got another green, but one of my favorites.
Oh my gosh, kale! I know. I keep saying that everything is my favorite, but I mean, we seriously have put three of my top 10 favorite things on the table.
Okay.
You know, today.
It's another green. We've already talked about arugula, but kale is. I mean, I love kale.
I love kale, and to me, kale is different than arugula. Kale is tough. And one of my favorite things to do with it that's sort of unusual for our kitchen is to actually make a pesto out of it or make a puree.
So instead of basil?
Instead of basil.
Okay.
You know, basil's a summer thing and makes really beautiful pesto, you know, in the summer. You know, but the idea of basil pesto in October or November or December or January is a little weird because it's not a seasonal thing, you know, for here.
So a kale pesto, we're pairing it then with the same olive oil and pine nuts?
Pine nuts or it's one where walnuts is actually a really good substitute because they have a slightly stronger flavor, and serve it on top of a puree of lima beans or navy beans or cannellini beans or something that they were using as a side dish in place of mashed potatoes. And for me, I don't personally eat a lot of meat, and so I will often have, you know, one of those bean purees with the grain, you know, with the grain, warm grain salad, to complete, you know, a vegetarian protein, you know, set.
Well, I have a question, and it's something I recently tried at BHK Cafe a couple of weeks ago, and it's your lavender latte. So a lavender syrup.
Isn't that crazy?
And I tried it in an iced latte, and it was really good. It was an afternoon, you know, my afternoon pick-me-up. I decided to go to BHK and get a lavender latte.
I love it.
So tell me about lavender in a coffee.
Well,
your lavender syrup.
I was going to say, let's talk about lavender first, and then we'll talk about pairing it, because there are some really magical pairings with lavender as well. Lavender is another one of those things like cardamom that is both a fragrance and aroma and a flavor, and they're each different, and they combine together sort of on your palate. We do our lavender syrup in-house. It's just a simple syrup of sugar and water, and then we throw the lavender blossoms in them and let it steep and strain it out to get that base. The beautiful thing about the flavor of lavender is that it has those really, really high pitched sort of citrusy, you know, aromatic notes that register both in your nose and on your palate, but really high, almost up inside your head.
Okay.
And then there are some really dark, earthy, grassy notes that register really, really low, you know, on your palate, almost down in your upper chest. And there's this little tiny line of flavor, so that sort of connects those together. But what that sort of roof and foundation do then is allow for other flavors to be suspended, you know, in between them. And depending on how dense those middle flavors are, that determines how strongly the lavender dominates the pairing. So if you put it with something that's really intense like espresso, which is really powerful and really sort of sharp and acidic, but also deep and dark, mm-hmm. that we get this sort of long vertical mm-hmm. flavor that goes all the way from inside your head down into your mm-hmm. chest. The other really magical, since we're sort of on the cusp of talking about sugar and we haven't talked about sugar yet, is lavender and chocolate.
Okay.
The crazy thing about the way the flavor works is that you put it on your – you don't get the aroma of the chocolate – of the lavender in the chocolate. It somehow gets encapsulated in it. But when the flavor of the lavender registers on your palate, which is after the chocolate registers, then you smell lavender. And it happens when you breathe across your palate. That's when the lavender registers. So you put that big lavender truffle, sort of in your mouth, and you get the cocoa, the bitterness from the cocoa powder, and that diminishes, and you get that creamy density of the chocolate, on your palate. And then something else starts to register, and you swallow, and then you breathe across your palate, and then all of a sudden your eyes open up really wide and your ears tingle because your whole head is full of lavender. But as a fragrance, even though
– So it comes back to – yeah.
Yes. Yes, so it's an incredible sort of physical sensation experience of a food pairing.
Well, thank you, David.
You're welcome.
I think we've successfully covered food pairing. What do you think? I think we could talk all day.
We could. I would love that.
Thank you.
Chef David Lewis of BHK Cafe sat down with Christina Thomas to discuss food partnerships last week. We're taking just a few minutes to discuss partnerships this week because public radio is a shining example of a partnership. You support KUAF and Ozarks at Large with your financial contributions, and we, in turn, convert your support into programming. Often during a fundraising week like this, you'll hear me talk about how your support helps provide news coverage from faraway places like the Sudan or Afghanistan. And that's true, but your support also means coverage from such places like Clifty, Lincoln, Turner Bend, and Figure 5. At Ozarks at Large, we're dedicated to getting to the places in the region that you haven't been to for a while, or maybe you've never been to. Well, many of our stories are about people and events in the larger cities of our listening area, Fort Smith, Fayetteville, Bentonville. We make a strong commitment to get out of our studios and to the smaller places as well. Later this week, we'll have a story from the Washington-Crawford County line that's an example of our desire to get into the Ozarks. It's about some wild, unnamed waterfalls that we were guided to during a warm March afternoon. And last week, Jacqueline Froelich took us along the Buffalo River to tell us about how the 40th anniversary of the buffalo receiving federal protection will be celebrated throughout the year. Jackie was also dedicated to telling us the story of how families coped in small communities like Cincinnati after tornadoes tore through there last year. From state-of-the-art recycling in Madison County to a modern take on the public library in downtown Gentry, we want to tell you the stories of the smaller places in our listening area as well. So, yes, your financial contribution keeps the stories coming from Washington, D.C., Tokyo, and London. And it makes it possible for us to tell you what's also happening in Springdale, Rogers, and Van Buren. But your support also helps us tell the stories from the little spots in between. If hearing the news from all over the world and all over your part of the world is important to you, remember, we can bring you these stories because of one big reason. You. Listeners like you support the programming on KUAF and Ozarks at Large. Without you, we couldn't do it. It's that simple. The partnership that we're really celebrating this week is you and us. You can participate in that partnership. If it's for the first time, that's great. If it's time for you to renew your partnership with public radio, please consider doing so right now. 800-522-5823 or online at KUAF.com. And thanks. The first Tuesday Music on the Mountain series continues tomorrow night in Clap Auditorium on top of Mount Sequoia in Fayetteville. This month, the guest artist is Emily Cates, no stranger to music fans in Northwest Arkansas and no stranger to Ozarks at Large. I invited her to come back to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio with guitar in hand to give us a preview of what we might hear tomorrow night in Clap Auditorium. And if you're a fan of Emily, you know that many of her songs are inspired by real people and real events. I asked her if people are sometimes wary of talking to her because they're afraid something they'll say or they'll do will end up in a song of hers.
You know, less so than people think, because so many times I'm in some social situation and somebody says something funny or we're talking about something or other, and someone will look at me and say, oh, I can see the wheels turning. There's going to be a song coming out of this. And they're hardly ever right. I mean, to tell you the truth, I'm at this point in my life especially, I'm a very lazy songwriter, but I've always been a lazy songwriter. I am not trying to write a bunch more songs. I've been writing songs for 45 years. You know, I probably will write, you know, another song. In fact, I just recently wrote a song and I'm working on another one now. But it's not like I'm just looking for every opportunity to write something clever.
Well, you say you're lazy, but you're prolific.
Well, I've consistently written about 4 songs a year over a period of about 45 years, and I don't necessarily do all those songs. Now, at the show on Mount Sequoia, I actually have a game plan. First of all, I might mention that Keith Grimwood from Trout Fishing in America is going to be playing with me, which will be really fun. And I have in mind 2 sets, and the first set, because I know there will be a lot of musicians in the audience, I'm going to do all songs about musicians or playing music. And some of these songs are songs I hardly ever do. Some of them are songs that people have heard. And then the second set I'm calling sort of Emily's Greatest Hits. And I'm going to do, a lot of the songs that people associate me with, such as Shallow Into the Gene Pool and Pico de Gallo and Small, Medium, at Large and things like that. But there will probably be people at this concert who are not like my regular audience, so I'm hoping, in other words, that there will be people there to whom some of these better known songs of mine will actually be fresh songs. I think that may be the case.
Efren, I want to bring you in, and again, I never quite get the title right that you're using for this. You are the you're not the organizer. You're not the curator. You are the.
We've been calling me the show manager.
Show manager.
Yeah, which means I don't do too much. I just make sure these guys show up and get set up on time and all that. And I do my best to introduce them, but my introductions are kind of awkward and stuff. But then again, people get a kick out of that awkwardness, I guess.
I would beg to differ. When Efren was doing a songwriter series called Songs in the Ville at the UARC Theater, he was always apologizing for he was trying to sort of ask leading questions to the other songwriters that he would bring in to get them to talk about their music careers and their songwriting process and stuff. And he always told me he felt really awkward doing that. Well, he was great at it. And he's great at introducing people.
I'm sure he is.
Yeah.
Do you ever talk with other songwriters about the act of songwriting?
Efren and I have actually, we sort of co-wrote one song, and we co-wrote with our friend Gary Schmidt another song. That was a song that Gary gave to me. He and Efren had worked on it some years before and had kind of abandoned it, and he was sort of revisiting it and wondered if I might have some ideas, and I changed around quite a bit. And then Efren got back in the thing, and he changed some things, but Efren actually does that song sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's...
And it wouldn't have been the song it is without...
Which song is
either
that?
Any of us.
It's not on Efren's new CD, but it's a song called Hurricane Coast of My Heart.
Right.
Yeah.
She gave you a nice little segue there. You do have a new CD, just like we mentioned. And you will have the CD release party at?
At Clamp Auditorium.
Okay. May 6th.
On May the 6th.
And you'll play?
Efren has asked me to play bass, and I'm very honored to do so.
If you have someone who influences a song and it's somewhat, tongue-in-cheek or sarcastic or something, would you tell them that they're the inspiration?
Absolutely. Kyle, I have put real people's names. I mean, on my most recent CD, I have that song Spilkus that actually not only has Robert Ginsberg's real name, but he actually does a little part
right
on the recording. So although the song itself is a fantasy. But
that's in good fun.
Yeah.
I mean, Robert,
absolutely.
You know, Robert's not well, I shouldn't speak for him, but he's not bothered by that.
Yeah. Well, in 1998, the first CD that I recorded up here, and it was sort of right when I was moving here from Austin also, I recorded a song called Who Even Cares About Love, and it was about the divorce of two good friends of mine down in Austin. And while I didn't mention any names, a lot of the mutual friends in Austin knew exactly who the song was about, and the people involved knew who the song was about. And sometimes I joke that, you know, that was one of the reasons I left Austin, was because I was writing these songs that were, you know, right out of people's lives, and they asked me to leave town. But I've done just as bad up here, you know. So
I think worse.
My song "Don't Gossip in the Sauna" was based absolutely on a situation with a person who used to live in Fayetteville, who actually moved to New Mexico shortly after I wrote the song. I don't think it was because I wrote the song making fun of her and her sauna, but it could have been. You never know.
Emily Cates, responsible for keeping Mayflower and U-Haul in business. Well, do you mind playing something that won't chase anyone away?
I don't think this will chase anyone away.
Okay.
I told my mom, I promised Dad, I wouldn't use four-letter words when I got mad, or take the name of the Lord in vain. So instead of swearing, this is what I'm saying. Who gives a rusty left-handed good gosh almighty on a stick flying sideways in the sky? I wish you'd find a slime-coated trash load of glorified double-wide to stick in your purse naked eye. 'Cause you're nothing but a slouch-ways mealy mouse guzzle-butted layabout without a snout or a spine. And you can stuff that low-down lint-covered do-wack-a-doodle where the sun don't shine. When I am old and silly in the head, I'll be planning for the time when I am dead. I want this epitaph engraved on my tomb in tiny little letters, only if there's room. Who gives a rusty left-handed good gosh almighty on a stick flying sideways in the sky? I wish you'd find a slime-coated trash load of glorified double-wide to stick in your purse naked eye. 'Cause you're nothing but a slouch-ways mealy mouse guzzle-butted layabout without a snout or a spine. And you can stuff that low-down lint-covered do-wack-a-doodle where the sun don't shine.
Emily Cates will perform tomorrow night beginning at 7 inside Clapp Auditorium at the Mount Sequoia Retreat and Conference Center in Fayetteville. Her concert is the latest in the Music on the Mountain First Tuesdays concert series. All proceeds raised help restore Clapp Auditorium. KUAF is supported by Walton Art Center, continuing the 10x10 series with the Whiffenpoofs, Yale University's all-male a cappella group, Friday at Arend Art Center in Bentonville. Dressed in tuxedos, this collegiate group will perform an evening of song plus tongue-in-cheek humor. Tickets and more information available at waltonartcenter.org or 443-5600. And KUAF is proud to co-sponsor the 2012 Susan G. Komen Race for the Cure. This 10K and 5K race, plus a one-mile family walk, will be held on Saturday, April 28th at the Pinnacle Hills Promenade in Rogers. A pre-race pasta party will be held Friday, April 27th. Race forms, pasta tickets, and more information available at ColemanOzark.org or 750-PINK. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, Decatur, a listener-supported service of the University of Arkansas J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences, pursuing peace through education at arkansas.edu/Fulbright. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks for tuning in. Antoinette Grajeda will join me tomorrow on the Tuesday edition of Ozarks at Large, another brand new edition. It's your financial support that makes Ozarks at Large and public radio and KUAF possible. If you haven't contributed yet, it's incredibly easy to do so at 800-522-5823. You can also pledge online at KUAF.com. Thanks so much to everyone who has already pledged. If you haven't done so yet, please consider doing so right now. And thank you.